You know, nobody wants to do your first deal.
Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we're here to learn from the experts.
Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio. We're so glad you could join us. My name is Jeter and Gross. I'm a real estate investor and a commercial property insurance broker. I've been an insurance broker for over 25 years, and my primary client is made up of real estate professionals, investors, landlords, property managers, developers, lenders, design professionals. And in an effort to be more of a resource than just insurance, I created this Commercial Real Estate Pro Network and CREPN Radio. And along those lines, I want you to know that if you have any insurance needs with respects to commercial real estate, I would gladly do all I can to help. Just reach out and let me know, and we will do what we can to help you. However you found us, whether it be YouTube, Google, LinkedIn, Twitter, iTunes, or commercialrealestatepronetwork.com, we are glad you're here. We would love to see your likes, your shares, follows, any comments. We would love to hear from you. Enough about us. Let's get on with today's show. Today's topic is the first deal. And this is one that struck a chord with me for years. For years, I've talked with friends, clients, strangers about real estate. Everybody gets excited about real estate. But the reality is that so very few have the guts or the ambition or the willingness to pull the trigger and actually do it. And it's always puzzled me, but it's the reality of probably a lot of things in life is there's the talk and then there's the walk. Today, our guest, he posted a post on LinkedIn, and I saw that, and it really spoke to me. So I reached out to him, and he agreed to come on and tell us his story and tell us about his journey into real estate, about his journey into the first deal, and all the trials and tribulations. It's a great interview, and I hope you enjoy it. And without any further ado, here's my interview with Jonathan Twombly of Two Bridges Asset Management. All right, today our guest is Jonathan Twombly. He's with Two Bridges Asset Management. And Jonathan, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
All right. Well, I want to say thank you again for taking the time to talk to us today. And just to kind of set the stage here a little bit for our audience, it was a post that you had on LinkedIn that I saw talking about your first deal that caused me to reach out to you. And we'll get into that here a little bit. But before we do, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got into real estate?
Sure. Happy to do that. My background was not traditional at all. I did not have really any kind of exposure to real estate in any kind of meaningful way until I'd say my 30s. Late 30s, I didn't work at a real estate shop before going out on my own. I was a lawyer and doing something pretty far away from real estate, which was commercial litigation. I was working here in New York at a big firm, litigating cases between Fortune 500 companies and working all kinds of crazy hours and not seeing my family and being pretty unhappy about it. And I got pretty burned out doing that and started looking around for other things that I could possibly do. And I first looked into finance, thought maybe that was a route for me. I definitely, as a lawyer, was feeling like, gosh, I mean, the money was good, but I was looking at my friends who were in banking or whatever, who were working the same miserable hours as I was, but making multiples of the money that I was. They actually had a plan where they could possibly just grind it out and retire at a relatively young age, where for me it was like, you know, I'm just going to grind this out forever. And I started looking into that. But this was really like right around, you know, right around the when the financial crisis happened. I think maybe I started looking into it sort of just before that. And then you know, Lehman collapsed and the bottom of the economy fell out. And, you know, here was contemplating this career change in my late 30s into a field, you know, that was collapsing before our eyes. And that didn't seem like it was going to happen. So I just put my nose back down for a little while. And, you know, at that point it was, you know, not happy with my job, but happy to have a job given what was going on. You know, I had friends at all those places that were falling apart, and it wasn't a fun situation. So I kept on working for a couple more years, and after I'd say, you know, we kept pretty busy through 2008, 2009, but about 2010, the recession really started catching up with us, and the work just really started drying up. And I had this long period at my job where I was, you know, basically getting paid to surf the internet all day, and it was really not a fun situation at all, because you're just, you know, you dread every knock on the door because you don't know whether they're going to give you work or whether they're going to fire you, and all right. You know. And both of those would be kind of crappy because I didn't, you know, I hated the work, but I also didn't want to lose my job. And I also hated sitting there surfing the internet for a living. That was also no fun. So I really saw that the writing was on the wall, and I started thinking about what else I might be able to do, and started thinking about real estate. I'd always kind of had an interest in it, and I was at that point in my career sort of nominally doing something related to real estate. I was litigating a lot of real estate stuff. So I was getting some exposure to it on the back end when things fell apart. And I just started networking like crazy with everybody that I could who was in real estate to see if I could try to break into the field. And during the time I was doing that, I did lose my job, and I was on severance and just trying to network with people. And, you know, I kept on getting feedback which said, you know, look, at your age, and at this point I was 40, at your age, with your background as a lawyer, you know, it's going to be really tough for you to break into this field. And one of my acquaintances actually sat me down and said, look, you know, I'm just going to give it to you straight. You have no chance of breaking into real estate in this city, coming from where you're coming from.
And were you looking more like as a broker, or what was the kind of the bend on where you were headed, or what?
Yeah. So my idea at that point, you know, given my background and where I'd come from and kind of what all my friends were doing, I was looking at, you know, trying to break into some kind of institutional platform, you know, like work for a private equity fund or, you know, some big developer or some kind of thing like that. That was just where my mind was. It wasn't ever thinking about, hey, I'm going to go do this on my own. Like, that just seemed like the height of folly to me. You know, like I didn't know anything about real estate. I wanted to go get trained on somebody else's nickel and make, you know, get paid a salary while I was doing it. But after getting, you know, my termination notice from my firm, and, you know, just really had no stomach to look for another law job at that point. I spent more than 10 years as a lawyer, hated pretty much the last seven of it, and really wanted to do something else. You know, so I was looking for something to do potentially in real estate, and sat down, had coffee with a friend of mine who's, you know, been in the business for 30 years, and he said, look, Jonathan, I'm not going to sugarcoat this. You are not going to, no one's going to hire you in this town, given your background. Like, so just forget about it. So the only way that you are going to break into this field is if you're out there and you meet somebody and they just happen to take a liking to you and they say, hey, why don't you become my partner? So I kind of took that, you know, thought about it, and was still continuing to talk to people, but now with a little less confidence about it. And lo and behold, I met somebody that I'd met earlier called me up and said, hey, can you come meet me for coffee? And when I did, she said to me, hey, you know, I've decided I want to start my own commercial real estate investment business. How would you like to be my partner? And I thought, man, I just had this conversation a couple of weeks ago. So because of the conversation, I don't think if I'd had that conversation before, I would have taken it as seriously as I did. But since I'd had just had that conversation with that friend of mine, I said, okay, well, let me think about this. And part of my process of thinking about it was to go talk to my friends that I trusted. And I asked a couple folks, and they said, well, look, why don't you let me meet this person, meet this woman, and I'll tell you what I think. And if I like her, I'll give you money to invest. So I had her meet a couple of my friends, and they both liked her, thought she was smart, knew what she was talking about. And they were like, okay, well, look, if you go do this, you know, you guys go find some deals, we'll give you money. So I hadn't even accepted this offer from her yet. I was just still asking their advice. But now here I was, I had like this offer to become a partner. I had two people saying, I'll invest with you. And at that point I thought, okay, you know, whatever misgivings I have about going into this kind of startup situation, you know, something is telling me that I really ought to take this chance, you know, and I was fortunately in a position to take a chance for a while. I was very lucky that my wife was not pushing me to go get another law job because she knew how unhappy I was. And so she let me take a chance, and I did. So there I was. I was now suddenly a partner in a real estate startup.
And you're attracting capital right out of the chute. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I was very fortunate, you know, that I had friends who were in a position to do that. But, you know, one thing that I've come to learn, and that, now this is now 5 years ago that this all happened, one of the things that I have learned in this business is that it's really intensely relationship driven. And, you know, people may say, hey, you know, you're lucky you had friends who gave you money, but I don't really look at it as luck. I look at it as like the result of 20 years of showing my integrity to those folks so that they knew that even though I didn't know a lot about real estate at that point, they knew that they could trust my judgment and that they could trust me. You know, I might make an honest mistake, but I wasn't going to make a dishonest mistake with them.
Right.
So, you know, so it wasn't simply a matter of luck. It was a matter of, you know, I think in parts of being in the right place in the right time, but a lot of it had to do with, you know, kind of like how you are in your life in terms of integrity and proving yourself to people. That's what had a lot to do with it, I think.
Sure. Well, and in this day and age too, I mean, you don't have to look too far for people that have been burned by, you know, less than, or people with not so much integrity, or, you know, things have come down. So that's clearly a bar of, or a hurdle you want to make sure you get over when you're looking to invest. So,
yeah,
I mean, it definitely speaks to you and your background there and relationships. Well, let's go forward here a little bit on this journey here and talk about your partnership. So you if I read, and I don't want to tell the story, I want to hear you tell it. You got into this partnership. What did you guys, what came of that? Did you go forward? Did you find a property?
Yeah.
Did you?
Excuse me. So yeah, so we did. I mean, we plunged in with both feet. My partner had, you know, so I was bringing the, you know, the supposedly what I was bringing to the partnership was the ability to raise money, and she was bringing the expertise of how to do real estate deals. And she had that expertise because she and her husband owned a number of multifamily properties in Louisiana and Texas. And they had actually bought a property, you know, out of auction, that was, you know, like a complete, you know, sort of distressed, dilapidated property, and they had turned it around, And he had said to her, like, look, I want you to learn this business. You're in charge. So she had run this whole two-year rehab of this pretty large property. I mean, it was 100 units or so. So she'd really been through the, you know, through the grinder on this thing. And, you know, she had a good sense of what was going on. So, so we decided, you know, we were going to look in Louisiana and Texas, where she and her husband already owned property. And we started looking for deals there. It was not easy, even though she and her husband already had property, you know, we were operating under a different name. You know, her husband wasn't involved in the business. We couldn't really rely on his track record. Plus, you know, she wanted to really do this on her own. And, you know, we ran into the same kind of problems that people run into when they get into this business, which is brokers don't take you seriously. You don't get to see good deals. You know, you're just kind of sorting through the junk that, that the brokers, you know, regular customers, the regular clients just passed on because it wasn't very good. So we would see deals that were like way overpriced and, you know, just or terrible condition or terrible location or whatever it was. You know, we was just, we're sorting through all this dreck. So it took us about 6 months or so, maybe a little longer, 8 months, to finally get a deal that we thought was worth pursuing. We'd made a couple of offers on a couple of deals. We never got them. We finally found this deal that we'd actually seen before, but between the time we first saw it and the time we saw it again, the seller had cut the price enough to make it worth pursuing. So put in an offer, it got accepted. You know, we were real happy about that. We started doing our due diligence on the property. The seller then turned out had another property for sale nearby. This is both in Louisiana. And we bid on that, got that one. So now we're doing two deals with the same seller. We've got our equity lined up because of the two guys that I'm friends with. We're working on the loans. We got the lender on board. We're due diligencing these things. We're down there doing our lease audits and got our contractor, you know, pouring over the deals, looking for stuff that needs to be fixed. And we got to, you know, through the underwriting process, through most of the credit committee with the bank. And we got to right before the loan closing, we're going to rate lock the loan, and the bank sent down their underwriter, you know, which is usually the last step in the process, just to go down there and check out the property and make sure there's nothing really, you know, glaringly wrong with it that they missed. And they call us up and they say, we're not doing the deal. And we said, why not? And they said, well, our underwriter went down there and didn't like what he saw, and we're not doing the deal. And we said, well, what is it? Is it like an engineering problem? And they said, no, not an engineering problem. I said, you know, is that, will you wait till the engineering report comes out? They said, no, we don't care what's in the engineering report. It doesn't matter. We're not doing the deal. So they sent us this report, which explains like why they're not doing the deal. And it was full of all this stuff, like, you know, the breezeways between the buildings were dirty, you know. There was a golf ball that came through a window in a vacant unit. You know, it was clearly that they had just come up with a pretext not to do the deal. So now here we were, was like, you know, we're like a few days away from, you know, our inspection period is about to end. We're getting close to when we're supposed to close. We don't really have time to ring on another lender, and now our lender's backed out, and we wound up having to terminate the. After we couldn't find another lender on short notice. So we were out a whole bunch of money out of our pockets and a whole bunch of time. And then a few weeks later, we were doing due diligence on the second deal. My partner found something about it that she didn't like, and she decided we need to terminate this deal too. And we terminated on the last day of our you know, sort of get-out-of-jail-free period, just to get the deposits back. But again, we're out all of our legal fees, bank fees, due diligence costs, time, you know, and it was just a horrible thing. So we went from riding high with, you know, two deals we're about to close to no deals we're about to close and out of pocket, you know, thousands of dollars plus, you know, months and months of supporting myself with no income. And, yeah, it was pretty devastating. I mean, it was really, you know, a really low point in my career.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes those things are better to, you know, have that, I guess the price of the education sometimes, I know I've paid those, what do you call them when you pay your...
pay your dues? Or,
yeah. I'm trying to think, tuition, I guess, is what I was going to try and say.
Yeah.
I've got a whole lot of that tuition, no degrees for that stuff, but... I'm kind of curious and don't want to race too far ahead, but knowing now what you know and your experience and, would those deals, would you still be attracted to them like you originally were, or do you see that there were, issues to, walk away from?
So those deals, I think are not deals I would have pursued today. They were a little bit too rough around the edges. You know, they would have required a bit too much work, and we weren't going into them, you know, sort of as truly repositioning deals where we would have been really well capitalized and been prepared for what it was going to involve. I think that the deals would have done fine, but we would have had like an on the job education in how to run a deal that has, you know, a lot of issues to it, you know, and how to do things on the cheap and maybe not the way that you really want to do them, you know, the kind of fix stuff with chewing gum and, you know, spit water
right.
and stuff rather than really putting in what it deserves. So on balance, you know, with a very long view to things, I'm kind of glad that we didn't close those deals. I mean, you know, I'm sure we would have made a lot of money, but I think it was in a long, you know, sometimes things happen for a reason. And I think that there was a reason why we didn't close those deals. And, you know, one reason I think was that we, even though we got along fine, we had a lot of respect for each other. As we were working on these deals, you know, when you're kind of working on stuff intensely, you get to know people pretty well. And one of the things that came up was that we had pretty different views on a number of things, about not so much about real estate, but about like how to run a business and, you know, how to deal with investors and those kinds of things. And I think that those would have become bigger issues going forward if we had stayed together. But what wound up happening was after we... those two deals collapsed, we were out a lot, you know, a lot out of pocket. And I think we both sort of felt like, you know, maybe we really just ought to go our own way. So we wound up winding up the business and, making an amicable but clean break of it. And, it's just going our separate ways. So,
well, you know, it's interesting because even in the, you know, just the overall kind of reference to relationships and people and that, you know, the partnership thing, I've been, doing insurance for 25 plus years and the best partnership I've ever seen was a guy that literally followed the book on when he set up the partnership, it was all about how to unwind it. And,
yeah.
I think that the majority of people get into whatever that relationship is, a partnership, and that just seems like so far away that it'll never happen. It's why let's not spend the effort on this. Let's get this thing going forward. And to the credit to this one customer, I mean, I've seen his deals come together and unwind, and it's very clean, it's efficient, and there's no hard feelings. It's all understood, and you know. On to the next. Are you still in contact with your former partner there? Or?
Yeah, actually, we haven't been in contact. But I understand she's still in the business, and I hope she's doing great. She certainly deserves it. So, with my background as a lawyer, especially being a litigator, where I only saw stuff after it fell apart, you know, after the deal fell apart, after the relationship fell apart. I was very conscious of setting it up to fail in a way, you know, like to fail in the best way. And I think because of that, we were able to kind of divide things up pretty easily and without any real, I don't really remember arguing with her at all about any of this, you know, about any of the breakup stuff. So it, we both handled it pretty smoothly, and that, you know, I think is a credit to her also and her character. But when you're talking before about, you know, your education, so, and things happening for a reason, you know, what happened next is kind of interesting when you look at it from those perspectives. So I guess, it, you know, not too long after my first partner and I broke up, I was having dinner with one of those friends who had, you know, offered to invest money with us. And, you know, I said to him, look, I not really sure what I'm going to do now. I might have to go back to practicing law again, which is not something I want to do, but, you know, I've got a family to support. And he said, listen, you know, slow down there. Don't run off half-cocked. Don't do anything you might regret. Why don't you and I become partners? And I'll back you in a venture, and you'll run it, and I'll just be in the background. And so we did that. And, you know, it's not something that he would have done if I hadn't spent 18 months getting my hands dirty, learning the business from the inside out, you know, making mistakes, but taking responsibility for them. You know, like the money that we lost was our own money. You know, our investors didn't lose, you know, they didn't lose anything. You know, we took it on the chin, and I think that all of those things showed him that I was, you know, not just someone who was a good friend, but, you know, someone who would be a good business partner. And I had really, you know, learned how to do the business, which I hadn't, you know, 18 months before. He was relying on her for the expertise and me just for having good judgment. But after those 18 months of hard knocks, you know, he was ready to invest in me as a partner. So that was when we formed Two Bridges Asset Management, and that was in the beginning of 2013. And, you know, it was after that that things definitely went on an upswing, but it still wasn't, you know, it wasn't smooth sailing. It was, you know, we still had all of the hard knocks or the hard rows to hoe that you might imagine for a new startup in this business.
Right. No, you've learned the language, but you still got to find the deals, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, as we kind of progress here, so you went from this partnership, you learned a valuable lesson. You've now got a new relationship that's agreeing to go forward as a partner. And tell us about how you guys, you know, strategy that you guys, you know, now that you got this new partnership, how did you decide to go forward in that?
So, you know, the setting of the partnership was the, I guess, the easy part. What we decided to do next, and, you know, he really left it to me to figure all this out. But I had, you know, now I was here with like a clean slate trying to figure out, you know, where I wanted to invest, what I wanted to do. We, you know, we had both agreed and had always both been of the opinion that, you know, New York real estate was just too expensive and too hard to make money on. And that, you know, so New York was out, and I'm just kind of, I mean, I like demographics. I can really geek out on like population studies and like, you know, stuff that probably bores most people to tears, but the 2010 census data had come out in 2012, and, you know, I was like tracking, I was digging into that data and like sorting it by population growth and, you know, trying to figure out where the markets were that were growing the fastest. And I decided that, I eliminated anything that was not growing faster than the country as a whole. And so that eliminated the whole Northeast anyway, and eliminated anything west of the Mississippi because it was too far to go from New York, as I learned when we were going out to Louisiana to look at those deals. It would take, you know, just the travel alone was a really huge time killer.
Right.
So I didn't want to deal with that. And so that eliminated that. And when I looked at the data, you know, what jumped out at me was the Southeast.
So I picked a bunch of markets I started tracking, and I was every month, you know, I'd get the unemployment data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and I was plotting all this stuff out in this Excel spreadsheet and trying to figure out, you know, where the jobs were coming back and where they still weren't coming back yet. And, you know, and for me, this is like, I had a great time doing this. And when I was looking at all this data, it kind of became clear to me that the Southeast was not just growing very strongly in terms of population, but that there were a few markets where the jobs had remained pretty strong and were coming back. And so I really started looking down there. And even before forming Two Bridges, I had been, you know, looking into these Southeast markets. My old partner and I had been talking about, you know, where else would we want to look? And one place that I thought of was, you know, based on partly in, because of this data and partly because I just liked it and had friends there, was Charleston, South Carolina. And I had gone down to Charleston in 2012 and took my family down and visited some friends. And while I was there, I asked some friends, you know, who are not in the real estate business at all, do you guys know any brokers down here? You know, is anybody in your network? You know, they were both professional people and they had professional networks. And, you know, do you guys know anybody who is a broker down there? And both of my friends came through with some good introductions. But my friend Abby in particular, she introduced me to her best friend's husband, who then introduced me to his partner. And his partner, his name is Tyler Flesh, was like, he was a broker, yes, but what he really was a multifamily acquisitions guy. And he'd been doing this with a fund for 15 years, and he had recently gone out on his own and was doing development work. So I connected with Tyler and his partner, and they were going to show me deals. Of course, then my old business partner and I broke up, and that kind of went on hold. But after I formed Two Bridges, pretty much the first call I made was to Tyler and said, hey, look, you know, I'm up and running now. I'm coming down. Let's go look at some deals. So, worked out an arrangement with Tyler, hired him to be my rep down there. And before I knew it, you know, we were down there crisscrossing the state of South Carolina, looking at markets and looking at deals.
Well, again, the who, comes together here that, your network is paying off, and you're starting with not just a cold call, but an actual, you've got the trusted relationship that's leading you to additional trusted relationships. And that's definitely found that to be the case in my life, as far as, you know, having that trust and the ability to work forward from there. That's a much more preferred way to go than crossing your fingers and hoping everything works. You mentioned a little bit about the data and really kind of combing over that and really, creating a strategy, I guess, at least from a standpoint of recognizing a community that's growing. And you mentioned even faster than the U.S. I didn't realize that was the case on there, but that's certainly would speak to a support, a need for housing. And jobs and the ability to pay for the rent and that. So that makes sense to me. And the more I talk to people like yourself, I recognize, you know, having a strategy and a plan and understanding the why you're doing what you're doing usually pays a lot of dividends, and you can stay the course. You're not going to be surprised by certain things because you have a certain amount of security a reason to be there, as opposed to just somebody presented you a deal, you took it, and now you don't know why the deal's falling apart kind of thing. I wanted to ask you just a little bit more. So you did your study and you picked your area, you've got your who, your broker picked out. Tell us more about, you know, kind of the class of real estate you were looking at. I mean, identifying the deal, you know, take us through your first deal here.
So in terms of the kind of stuff that, you know, we were looking at, I had a couple, a couple thoughts. Like being a litigator, I always was always worried about the downside, right? You know, I know a lot of entrepreneurs are like super optimistic and they're always seeing all the upside and thinking about how much money they're going to make and how great things are going to be. You know, for me, I always felt like I can't trust the upside. I don't know what's going to happen, but if I can lower my risk somehow, then, all things being equal, I should be better off. So I was always looking at how I can lower my risk. So, you know, population growth, that's a way you can lower your risk because, you know that all things being equal, if the population is growing, you got people looking for places to live, and it's going to be easier to fill your apartment, at least to the break-even point, if you've got population growth, you know, that's strong. So that was one thing. Second thing is, you know, we just come out of the recession, and I was looking at, you know, who were the people who had to rent after the recession. You know, wealthy people were still doing fine. They'll always do fine. And they were the ones who were, you know, rubbing their hands together at all the cheap real estate around them that they could now buy on the, you know, for less than it was going for a couple of years ago. But for average people, you know, they were the ones who maybe either had to continue renting or, you know, maybe they'd been a homeowner before and they were now having to rent. And, you know, given that situation, it just seemed to me that the smarter course was to go into the kind of real estate that was always going to have renters, you know, renting it, and that you're going to get in for, you know, a lower price. You're going to take less risk on, you know, you're not taking on some brand spanking new property that's trading at a huge, you know, premium. And, you know, if you're going kind of down the market a bit to the places that, you know, you're not looking at what the 1% is renting, but you're looking at what normal folks are renting, you know, those places are more likely to stay full. And, you know, and if the economy really goes downhill and those folks lose their jobs, then there's probably going to be people who are going to be looking to save money who are then going to come in and replace those folks who've left. That just seemed like the smart thing to do for me in terms of trying to protect myself against the downside risk. So we've always looked at, B and C class properties, which trade at a big discount to new construction. The returns are just better because, you know, you're not paying a premium and you're not competing with the big buyers, the institutions who are willing to pay, top dollar for those properties. So that's the class of asset that we've always looked at from the beginning. And we'll always will. I don't think we'll ever change that model.
And you spelled out kind of the justification and the reasons why. I mean, you know, I remember a guy that I actually a guy I bought my first rental from. He was explained to me like this, the pyramid. He said, the guys on top, they can pay cash any day, every day. They don't need what I'm trying to sell. But as you work your way down, there's less and less options, and there's always going to be a bigger demand for that. So I definitely subscribe to that.
And you know, the other thing that we've discovered subsequently is that, given what's happened in the markets, you know, the last few years, you've got at least half the new construction is going into about 12 submarkets around the country, right? But that's not necessarily where the population is going. In the places where we've been looking, you know, in South Carolina and in smaller markets, and I know the same thing is happening elsewhere, to the extent that anything is getting built at all down there or in those markets, it's that Class A luxury, chock full of amenities property. And there's only, there's a really limited number of people who can afford to rent that stuff. There's no new supply coming on at all for workforce housing, for regular middle class, working class people. There's no new supply at all. And so, it always kind of boggles my mind when people tell me, oh, we want to invest in Class A, because that's where all the supply is, and they're fighting over this small number of people and building ever more apartments for them. And for everyone else, you know, there's nothing new being built at all. So it again supports the idea that you'll stay full, you know, which is, I think, what you really got to be aiming for in this business.
Yeah, you know, and even to support that, your thinking there, there was something I read, I want to say it was last week, and I don't remember if it was in the journal or what it was, but it was speaking to that there's a migration that's begun, and it is the millennials are beginning to couple up and realizing that, 600 square feet and a wife and kid and all the stuff that a kid brings along don't fit in the 600 square feet like it did when it's just you and your cell phone. So,
yeah,
there is a little bit of a migration out to the burbs already. So I think it'll be interesting. I mean, I think the one thing that I continue to find, you know, the cycles of any marketplace are always fascinating to me. But this one in particular, I think will be interesting how it continues. I think the memory of the crash fades pretty fast as you see everything going up. But, you know, if you go back and look at history at all, there's some sort of a correction or an adjustment that will occur. I mean, that's the marketplace. Yeah. But anyway, I appreciate where you're thinking and do agree with you that BC product is always going to have demand. And like you said, even that there's nothing being built. I mean, that's just not what's being built.
It just isn't. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, so tell us about how you went about identifying your first deal and some of the, details on your first one.
Yeah, sure. So we got started in 2013 with this business. Tyler and I were looking for deals and running into the same kind of thing again. You know, where even though he knew everybody there was to know down there, you know, and he'd reached out to a lot of his old broker contacts. We just weren't seeing anything that we wanted to buy, and it was, you know, getting to be pretty frustrating. And here I was going on now a couple of years of just, you know, felt like banging my head against a wall. I was wondering if I was ever going to succeed. You know, should I just give up? And finally, you know, Tyler got us a break what he did was, he, as I mentioned before, he'd been doing a lot of development deals on his own and was trying to make it as a developer down in the Charleston area. And he had a partner on a number of his deals who was an old real estate guy, really well established. And called her his niece, but it's really kind of a real family friend, you know, real close friend of his, had a daughter who was a very successful commercial real estate broker out in the upstate in South Carolina, which is out the Greenville Spartanburg area. It's between Charlotte and Atlanta for folks who don't know the geography, right along I-85. And this is really like the manufacturing belt of South Carolina, where BMW is there and Michelin is there, and a lot of suppliers for the auto industry have moved in there. So Tyler reached out to his partner, and his partner said, go talk to Kay. And so we got an introduction to Kay, and with the benefit of that personal introduction, we went out to Greenville, paid her a visit in her office to introduce ourselves. And since we came in with that personal introduction, she treated us differently than she would have if somebody just coming off the street. And she said, "Hey, look, guys, great to meet you. We talked through what we were looking to do, and." She said, "I just got this deal in the door in the last couple of days. Haven't actually even shown it to anybody yet. We haven't even put our package together yet. But, here it is. Why don't you guys go drive the property and take a look?" So it was up in Spartanburg. It was about 30 minutes away. We drove up there. And literally once, the moment we drove onto the property, we knew that this was a good deal. It was just much better looking than the stuff I had been working on in Louisiana. And, Tyler with his, 15 years of experience of doing these deals,
you know, thought it was a good deal. And, you know, we looked at stuff like we were there in the middle of the day. There were hardly any cars parked there at all, which meant everybody was working. You know, the cars that were there were nice cars, you know. And the place just had a good feel to it. So, you know, I came back to New York. Tyler went back to Charleston, ran the numbers, came up with an offer, made the offer, and Kay was great. She convinced the seller not to put the property on the market. You know, she convinced him to take our offer, and he did, and we were in business. You know, that's how we got the first one. So it was a, you know, 1970s product, 102 units, had just been through a small rehab, not a major overhaul, but, you know, they'd done a little bit of a, you know, reposition on the property. And, we were good to go.
Sweet. You're in business, huh?
Yeah. So after, you know, this is like almost 3 years, 2.5 years after I first got started, we finally had a deal, and, you know, we had the thing under contract, but we still, you know, we were getting close to the finish line. We had a lot of trouble getting the debt this time around because we were a new group. My partner was able to use some of his relationships to help us get debt on the first deal. And we were things just kept on coming up. Like, suddenly we found out during due diligence that even though the seller didn't have any flood insurance because he didn't have to, the flood maps had been redrawn. And now it was in a flood zone. It was considered in the 100-year flood zone, which it hadn't been a year before. So we had to get flood insurance. That kind of messed with our underwriting a bit. And then right before we were going to close, so our inspection period ended when we had, you know, we could get out of the deal for any reason at all. Maybe a week before that happened, the environmental came back and said that they had to do a phase two environmental, which means that they had found some kind of indication of an environmental issue, and they had to now investigate. They had to do testing to see whether there really was one. And the issue was that there had been kind of uphill from the property, there was a highway maintenance facility that had they'd been using PERC, which is this cleaning material, which is often, used to be used in dry cleaners, right? And it's a carcinogen.
Right.
And now if there's PERC, you know, you got to remediate the PERC, and that would have been like this, you know, huge costly thing. And so, you know, here I was like a week before this was, you know, we were going to have to go hard with our deposits. And I'm thinking like, is this happening to me again? Like, am I going to have to back out of this deal now? You know, and up to the last minute trying to decide, you know, what do we do? Should we cut and run? And, you know, I talked over to my partner. He said, look, let's just roll the dice. You know, let's just go, you know, just got to go forward and see what happens. So we did. And, you know, fortunately there was no PERC on the property. So we were good to go. The lender was happy and we were able to close.
Yeah. Boy, those last minute details. You've certainly been baptized with all of the ones I've heard of. I've always been amused, you know, how on the commercial lending, how they're able to dance that thing right up to the line there. And I know I've had customers that have had the offer sheets and they've gone to closing and the money wasn't there. The offer was pulled after they'd already paid their fees. And certainly sounds like you've been through that. The flood insurance, remind me after this, I've got something I want to point you to. I did an interview earlier on a guy that can maybe help you with that.
Sure.
So you got your money. It sounds like it was not as easy, but it sounds like it was more a matter of the newness of you and that you hadn't had any deals under your belt. Is that kind of what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah. You know, nobody wants to do your first deal, you know,
right.
Whether it's, we were lucky we had investors who wanted to do the first deal, but very often that's a problem for people, but lenders don't want to do your first deal. Brokers don't want to do your first deal. You know, nobody wants to do your first deal. Everybody wants to do your second deal, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
That's so funny. Nobody wants to do your first deal. So on the deal, as far as financing goes, percentage down, was it 25% down or?
Yeah. So we always finance our deals that way. 25% equity down payment, and we finance the rest. So, the actual equity that we'll raise will wind up usually being about 30% because we've got closing costs and, things like that that need to be paid for. It winds up being about 30%, but 25 is what goes into the deal.
Got it. And management, are you managing it yourself? You hired professional management local? How are you?
Yeah, so we do local third-party management all the way. They have a skill set that we don't have. And frankly, when you're doing commercial deals like we're doing, we're buying properties that are 100 units and up, and even though these are considered small deals for the lenders that we deal with, they still they're loaning us a couple million bucks. One of their checklist items is there's got to be an approved manager, right? So they won't even lend to us if we tell them we're going to self-manage. But we have no interest in doing that. It's not the business that we want to focus on. Our business is finding deals, overseeing the property management company, making sure that they're doing their job, and so the investors can rest easy. But letting them do the job that they're good at, so that's the model.
So more of an asset management position.
Yes, exactly.
Gotcha. Are you guys, are you buy and hold? Is that your strategy? Do you have any kind of a sunset exit plan when you buy, or is everybody committed ongoing?
No. So, our deals are set up to expire after 10 years, unless, we agree with the investors to hold further. We probably won't hold the deals for the whole 10-year period. We'll probably exit them before that. But the investors don't have any obligation to stay, in the system if they want to take their money out. That's their, they're free to do that at that point.
Got it. Your story, I love the story just because, I love real estate and been doing it myself. And, what it just reemphasizes to me is the number of people that are interested in it, and how easy it is for people to get dissuaded because of the time. I mean, it's always easy to get excited because you heard about somebody making money in something. It's like, picking the stock because it's high and you pick it and it goes down and you lost your money and you didn't do your homework. And what I hear in your story is the education process, and all of that gives you the confirmation so that when you do a deal, you have a sense of what's going to happen, and there's still going to be things that you hadn't anticipated, but
yeah,
like you said, you've taken out the risk, or a lot of the risk. I mean, the area, you have a purpose for being in the area. You mentioned the lack of supply. It all speaks to a well thought out plan. And I would think that anybody investing in you or with you would certainly appreciate that. Let me ask you, so on the all of the lessons you've learned, what's the biggest lesson that you've learned?
Wow, that's a tough question, because I've learned so many lessons in this business. And I continue to learn lessons.
You can give me a couple
day.
Lessons. You.
Well, sticking with it is obviously one thing. I think I went into this like a lot of other people, underestimating how hard it was going to be to actually pull this off, because I thought, hey, look, I've got guys who want to give us money. We've got the equity lined up. This is going to be easy. And it wasn't, and even after we got deals under contract, it wasn't easy. And even, when everything was lined up,
we still had moments where we thought it was all going to, come apart. And frankly, even after closing, we've had issues with properties that required a lot of, attention and sleepless nights, to get things where they need to be. A lot of the education has happened, after closing. So the sticking to it, perseverance is just really, really essential. Another thing that I've learned is and we've talked about it a couple times already today, just the, I can't emphasize enough how important relationships are in this business. People want to do business with people that they know and they trust and they like, and it doesn't matter whether it's an investor or a broker or a lender. It really comes down to relationships. So you have to invest time in building those relationships, and you have to, you got to prove to people that you have integrity and that you're somebody that can be trusted, and you got to maintain that once you've got it, because, it takes, what do they say about trust? It takes a lifetime to build it and you can lose it in an instant. It's vitally important, that you have, a reputation for being trustworthy, and that you really, honor your word on stuff. And it's a business full of people who have bad reputations. So, people expected it to not be bad, to not be trustworthy sometimes. So you really got to work hard on that. And then, the last lesson I'd say I'd learned is that closing the deal, like, that's when the real work starts. If you're an asset manager or you're a property manager, now you've got this property on your hands, and it doesn't run itself. There's a lot of moving parts there, and you got to be prepared for all of this. And if you're a new owner, and even if you're working with a professional management company that's good, at the end of the day, you're responsible for the performance of this asset. And if things are not going the way you want them to go, it's down to you. You can't make the excuse that, the management company this, the management company that. If they're not doing their job and you haven't done something about it, that's your problem. So, you've got to, I think a lot of people have this idea that income, that real estate's a passive asset, you set it and forget it. It's just not true. It's not mailbox. It's only mailbox money if you invest your money with someone like me. Then it's mailbox money because I'm watching the store for you. But if you're doing it on your own, it is not mailbox money. It is stay on top of things money. It's hard work money. Now, it might not be, grinding it out 10 hours a day in the office, but you got to be prepared to deal with stuff. And so that's also something that I sort of knew it in the back of my mind, but I didn't really know it until I had to know it, which is after we started closing deals.
Right. No, I'm always amazed at the level of anxiety I have going up to the deal. Just, I don't know why. It just personally, I get kind of super freaked. But once it gets going, and it's I have a rhythm of kind of knowing, the what's going on, and I don't know, just a level of comfort moving forward. But that's a lot of, because you've done the homework. It's
because you've done it before. Yeah.
Yeah. But the anxiety going up to something new, there's always just, I don't know what it is, but it drives me nuts every time that I'm, about ready to do something.
Yeah. Me too. I mean, I've closed a bunch of deals now, and it's the same every time. I mean, right up until, literally until the lawyer calls me and says, okay, the deal is closed, you own it now. Like, up until that point, I'm always waiting for something to go wrong, so.
Well, clearly your story so far, you've got enough reasons to, wonder where they're going to pull out of the hat this time
Yeah.
But, hey, let me ask you, so going forward, we talked about the first deal. How do lenders view you now? And what do you, as you add to your portfolio, or is it?
So now, we've got a great relationship with a bank that we work with. We've done three of our four deals with them. We always get to work with the same closing team there. It's very smooth. They like our deals, they're performing well. So, you know, they're happy to lend to us. So that's really not an issue. And getting deal flow, also not an issue. Same thing, you know, once you have closed deals, not just the brokers that you work with, but the other brokers in the community will find out, because they're always watching, the closing reports, and people start to reach out to you with deals, and the more you do it, the better the deals get. You start getting off market stuff, and you're not just relying on public listings. So it gets easier from those perspectives. You know, raising equity capital is still always an issue. You know, that's probably the hardest piece of the puzzle, I think, is getting more investors, especially when you're dealing with retail investors. You know, they don't have an endless flow of savings to pour into deals. You know, so you've got to constantly refresh your network of people who can put money into deals. Until you get to the point where you're dealing with bigger sources of capital, which is where we're trying to go now. But we still work with smaller investors, and that's always it's always an issue. So,
right. Well, and I think that will always be. Otherwise, everybody would be doing it, and wouldn't probably be as good of a thing going forward. Economies of scale. How many doors do you guys have under management right now?
Yeah. So now we have 404, and they're all pretty close together. So we're able to run them pretty efficiently. With a single executive manager who oversees all of them, and we have assistant managers on all the properties and leasing folks. So we're also able to have the maintenance guys go between properties and help each other out, and we can bid out contracts for landscaping and pest control and all those sorts of things. So definitely, when you talk about sort of value add, a lot of people have the idea that a value add deal is a deal where you take over a distressed property and you turn it around and you upgrade it. But that's not the only way to do value add. I mean, we do value add on the management side, where we're buying properties oftentimes from folks who, if that's their only asset, they don't have the ability to have any economies of scale. And we bring in professional management, and we try to buy close to stuff that we already have, so we can have economies of scale, and we can run it more efficiently than the prior owner did. So that's a different kind of value add, and that's a lower risk value add, because you've got a cash flowing asset that you're buying.
You're not trying to control the income side of the equation, but you're able to kind of reduce the expense side of the equation. I like that. That approach. Any advice for somebody that's where you were 5 years ago, looking to do a deal or looking to get into real estate?
Yeah, I do. I picked up some lessons along the way about how to approach brokers when you're first starting out. And part of this was stuff that was natural to me because of my background as a lawyer and just sort of certain ways of preparing for stuff, or always being over prepared for everything. Some of it I kind of had just had to learn. And, when you're starting out, getting brokers to A, pay attention to you, and B, take you seriously and show you good deals is really one of the biggest challenges that people face. So I put together a little guide, basically a 21-day makeover, to kind of take you from, being a newbie to being a new pro, as I like to call it. Just because you're new at this doesn't mean that you have to be a newbie. You can really be a new pro, and it all depends on how you show up and how you prepare yourself and the kinds of things that you're doing before you meet with brokers and the way that you go about meeting them. That can make all the difference between whether they're going to take you seriously and whether they're not going to take you seriously. So if you go to my website, which is the Mortar. It's the Mortar Real Estate Blog. The URL is www.themortarblog.com.
M-O-R-T-A-R?
M-O-R-T-A-R, yep. At themortarblog.com, if you sign up for my mailing list, you will get this 21-day guide to how to show up and put your best foot forward for brokers and get a head start on your competition as opposed to the folks who are not doing that.
No, that's great advice there. I know I remember a deal and just, you know, showing up with all the numbers and being able to tell a story left, right, and didn't take a whole lot of extra explanation, and just the perception or the reception I got from the bank, as opposed to showing up with, you know, a bunch of stray information that they had to decode. Definitely a good advice there.
Yeah. It works for everybody you deal with, you know, but it really, you know, you can really change the impression that you give off by how you prepare for these meetings with folks, and you know, really change the way that they perceive you and how seriously they take you by what you what you have prepared and how you talk to them even before you meet them and how you deal with them. So you know, I really encourage people to go grab that guide. I think it'll really help you a lot if you're getting started.
Right, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes here, so people can click on that and go grab that. That's great.
Yeah, thanks.
Kind of, I feel like we've been down the story, and I your story. I mean, I really appreciate you taking the time to you know, share with us your journey and your story and how you came to be from a you know, frustrated attorney to now asset manager of 400 plus doors. Is there anything that I missed that you wished I would have asked?
No, I think we've covered it all and probably more than I'm sure your listeners are probably sick of the sound of my voice at this point, but
I hope not.
Yeah, I can't think of anything else that we haven't covered.
Well, good. Well, Jonathan, again, I want to say thank you for taking the time. And before I let you go, what's the best way for somebody to get in touch with you if they'd like to reach out and connect with you? And
yeah, the best way is to go again, you know, to the Mortar Blog. You can, as you know, get on my mailing list there. If you write to me, I will write back to you for sure. I try to answer all my email. You could contact me at Jonathan@themortarblog.com if you want to email me directly. Very happy to hear from any of your listeners, Darren.
All right. Well, Jonathan, again, I appreciate you taking the time, and ask that you'd be receptive. We do this again. I'd love to hear more about your story as you go forward.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to talk to you and your listeners again. It's been a great pleasure, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Jonathan Twombly and his story on making it happen in commercial real estate. I think it's a fascinating story, and it's one that I love hearing. And I can't encourage you enough also to check out his newsletter and get his 21-day program turning you from a newbie into a pro and help you prepare for investing in commercial real estate. And the link, if you look in the show notes, I've got it there, but just so you, if you're listening, it's themortarblog.com, themortarblog.com. All right. Let's see here. Again, I want to reiterate that if you like what we're doing here, we'd love to hear from you. Your likes, shares, follows, anything you can do to help spread the word about Commercial Real Estate Pro Network is greatly appreciated. You can find us, don't forget, on Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @CREProNetwork. Would love to see you follow us on that. And let's see, what else? Your likes, shares, follows, comments. We already talked about that. We'd love to hear from you. And don't forget also, as an insurance broker, if you have any commercial real estate insurance questions or need any help, please reach out to me. I will do all I can to help you. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network's CREPN Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.